Welcome to KUOW Speakers Forum, a venue for spoken word presentations. In many forms, we feature writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. I'm your host, John O'Brien. Best-selling author Susan Casey was a former competitive swimmer with extensive experience in ocean swimming. So it surprised her when she realized she had never swum with dolphins. That changed when she unexpectedly encountered a pod of spinner dolphins during a solo swim off Maui. Casey was so affected by the experience that she spent the next few years researching dolphins around the world. The result is her latest book, Voices in the Ocean, a journey into the wild and haunting world of dolphins. There are 43 species of dolphins in the world, ranging from 3-foot Hector's dolphins to 25-foot orcas. They are generally found near coastlines in relatively shallow water. Casey charts their long evolution, from their origins as wolf-like earth dwellers to life in the ocean. She explains the similarities and differences between dolphin and human brains, and she details the history of human and dolphin interaction, for better and worse. Dolphins can understand human language, call each other by name, recognize themselves in reflections, count, pull pranks, mourn, throw tantrums, and rescue each other and humans. Casey was struck by how interested dolphins are in humans. She questions how our fascination with them might become more beneficial to these remarkable creatures. Susan Casey's other books include The Wave, about the history of giant waves, and The Devil's Teeth, about great white sharks. She spoke at the Seattle Public Library Central Library on August 17th, 2015. Thanks to Anna Tatashev for this recording.
Good evening, everyone. I want to welcome you to the Seattle Public Library. I'm Emily Grayson, and I'm a librarian here at the Central Library. I'd like to welcome you all, and thank you for attending tonight's presentation by bestselling author Susan Casey. I would now like to introduce Karen Maeda Allman from Elliott Bay, who will say a few words about our speaker. Karen?
So this evening, it's my pleasure to introduce Susan Casey to the Seattle Public Library. She's read here before. She's also read at Elliott Bay before, and it's always the pleasure to welcome her back. She's a former competitive swimmer who was on the Canadian national swim team for years and then became a journalist. She's worked for Time, Sports Illustrated Women. She was editor-in-chief of O Magazine. She's also written and worked as a development director for Outside. Her previous books include The Wave and The Devil's Teeth, and we have those books available. But she's really here to speak about Voices in the Ocean, a journey into the wild and haunting world of dolphins. And I'll also add that orcas and belugas are among those discussed in our book, and she will tell you why that is. This is a particularly timely topic and particularly important to our region. We're one of the areas that she writes about where wild capture of orcas for marine parks happened for many years, and we still have endangered dolphins and orcas in our waters. These are very intelligent and feeling creatures, as she shows us. Though some of the research that she talks about in her book and also some of the information about the marine park life and capture is very difficult to read, I think that she strikes a nice balance, showing us why we should care about these intelligent, wonderful animals. And I think that many of you here are familiar with at least some of the issues and are already very, very interested in hearing about this topic. So please join me in welcoming Susan Casey to the Seattle Public Library.
Thank you so much. I'm just very happy to be back here. I love Seattle, and it's always a pleasure. You're an ocean town, too, which is a wonderful place to be talking about dolphins and, of course, all the magical creatures that live in the parallel universe that encompasses 95% of the living space of our planet. Voices in the Ocean is the crazy, colorful, chilling, thrilling, multi-year odyssey that I made into the world of dolphins, which is as you'll see, quite an intriguing world with a spectrum of extremes on it, particularly when we encounter them. Like all my books, it began with a sort of consuming curiosity that came from various sources. In this case, it was an encounter that I had on Maui with a pod of wild spinner dolphins. And those of you who may have read some of my other books know that I've spent a lot of time in the ocean with large creatures, but I had never had a sort of an up-close and personal encounter with dolphins, weirdly enough, because I do spend a lot of time there, and I swim, and I mean, at times I see sharks all the time. I had one time said to my Laird Hamilton, who's one of the main characters in The Wave, the surfer, you know, he always sees dolphins. I said, I never see dolphins. He said, Susan, you're going to have to work on your vibe. So when dolphins did come into my life, it was a kind of a magical moment and a really intriguing time as well, because I was in the depths of grief. I had lost my father very suddenly, and he was really the center of my universe. He was the rock and the reason I was able to go off and have wild adventures, and I always knew that he would be there to ground and to answer the phone and to talk me down from any bad situations or anything worrisome, and then suddenly he was gone. And no matter what I tried, I couldn't shake this grief, and I'd even gone so far as to try and scientifically study grief to figure out, well, how do you get past it? And nothing had helped. So on this sort of gray and gloomy night, I was visiting Maui. At the time, I lived in New York, and I was editing a magazine, but I went to Maui as often as I could, because that place has always been a lot of solace for me. Anything that's completely surrounded by the Pacific Ocean is like a church to me. So I was there, and it was my last night, and I had driven across the island to swim in one particular bay, but when I got there, the weather was unenticing, and it was getting dark, and it was kind of choppy, and you know, not the sort of conditions you would typically find it appealing. But I decided to go in anyway. And I wasn't that concerned with self-preservation at the time. And I swam, just went for about a three-quarters of a mile swim. And there had been a big spate of shark attacks in Maui, so I was a little bit aware of this large gray body that came underneath me and this large dorsal fin. And I looked, and it was a dolphin. And this particular spinner dolphin, was staring right at me. I'm just going to play a little video clip here to show what it was like, although I was in slightly different water. Now, these are bottlenose dolphins, but it is like encountering a society, a sort of a roving band under the water. It's a collective, and when they surround you, you're aware that you're being looked at. There's somebody home behind each set of eyes. And they're very curious. They have very good vision. They sonar you, of course. Their main sensory means of navigating through the ocean is through auditory, which makes sense when you consider that in the ocean, light is scarce, but sound travels fast and far and can be used even in darkness. These spinner dolphins that I encountered, the ones that are in Hawaii, they're small dolphins. They're kind of demure. And when I noticed when I saw them that they were touching. They were always touching. There's always, when you see dolphins, and I have now seen them many times since then, there's always a sense of pairs or trios or, you know, synchronized swimming. There's always touching, and it's a very important bonding part of their society. And as you can see, they're sort of beautiful. They're shy, but they're also very athletic. And spinners are called spinners because they can rocket out of the water and do like 7 revolutions in the air and multiple aerial backflips. And the theory for why they do that is everything from because they like to and it's fun, to they're signaling one another to say what the status of the pod is, or they're trying to get remoras, the little suckerfish, off their bodies. And I often saw dolphins with a lot of these remoras, and they sometimes bleed, so I don't think it's fun to have remoras stuck to you. So what was interesting about the encounter, aside from the fact that it was a first for me, was that I got to swim with them for about 15 minutes, and I lost track of time and space, and it was very calming. And eventually they swam away, and I mean, I could hear the noises that they made and the sort of cryptic communication that they had amongst themselves. Of course, I had no idea what any of it meant, but they chose to stay with me. They could have rocketed off in an instant, and I saw that as just sort of a real gift. When I got back to the shore, I was getting out, and I walked back to my car up this cliff, and I got to the car and opened it, and with some surprise realized that for at least 30 minutes, I hadn't been sad at all. I wasn't even in the space that I had been occupying for almost 2 years. And interestingly, that didn't go away. I went back to New York. I never quite felt the same kind of numbness and despair again. That really got my attention. And so I started asking questions of myself and Googling and finding out all kinds of intriguing things about dolphins. And the more I sort of poked into their world, the more astonished I was at the depth and the breadth of it, the science, the wackiness, the sort of like the rainbow of information about dolphins that was out there. And I'm going to run through, I wish I had another like 3 hours to speak to you, because the biggest challenge I had in this book was to somehow take everything that I had learned about dolphins and distill it into a shot glass. And by dolphin, I don't just mean flipper. I mean, sometimes when we think of dolphins, we think of bottlenose dolphins because they're iconic. But actually, I write about all the species of dolphins, and there are about 37 species of oceanic dolphins, ranging from the tiny Hector's dolphin, which is about 3 feet long, all the way up to orcas, which are the largest dolphins. And there's a group of animals, along with orcas, false killer whales, melon-headed whales, and pilot whales, which collectively with orcas are the group of dolphins known as blackfish. And they're large. But when in the taxonomy, the word whale doesn't mean anything specific. It just means it's a large member of the species. There are also 5 species of river dolphins, which are just incredibly cool looking, and I'll show you a picture. So all of these tribes within the dolphin family have their own customs, their own means of hunting, their own ways of existing in this three-dimensional world that they inhabit, as opposed to our two-dimensional one. They are unique as nations. And they all have different personas. And in fact, science now knows that the individual dolphins themselves are as individual as we are. They have signature whistles that are their names that are given to them at birth by their mother or most likely another mature female. They keep those whistles throughout their lives and refer to themselves with them. And there was a study done quite recently that determined that even when two dolphins who have been close, either family or close associates, friends, are separated, after 20 years they react when they hear one another's signature whistle. So dolphins have very good long-term memories and very close bonds that are really tantamount to the kinds of bonds that we have with one another. Now, the dolphin world has its fair share of extreme light, extreme wonder, magic, and extreme darkness. And one of the beginnings of the sort of the dolphin, the era that I think of as a sort of a burgeoning awareness of dolphins, the 50s and the 60s, has a very important character in it, and his name is John Lilly. And I know some of you are familiar with John Lilly, but I'm often surprised at how few people really know that much about him. He was really important to our awareness of dolphins, and he was also very colorful, larger than life, controversial, very curious, very brilliant, and some people would say very crazy. He The movie Day of the Dolphin is loosely based on his work, and so is Altered States. And in this picture, which was taken in 1960, he is in a lab, his lab called the Communication Research Institute in the U.S. Virgin Islands. Now, how did he get to the U.S. Virgin Islands? Because typically, government funding doesn't allow for the purchase of, you know, oceanfront property on the Caribbean Sea. Now, but Lilly was not your average scientist. He was a neuroscientist who was also a physicist, a psychologist, a real polymath of a scientist, and he worked for the military a lot. He was particularly interested in the mind, and during his Lilly's neuroscience era, the 50s and 60s, so was the government interested in the mind. It was the Cold War. It was a time when it would have been very handy to be able to poke an electrode into some spy's brain and get them to talk. And it was early days in our understanding of how any of this worked. So Lilly was in his lab, funded by NASA, by the National Institute of Health, by the Department of Defense, by the Navy, studying dolphins because their brains were so large and so like equally complicated as our own. On the right of the screen, you can see a bottlenose brain, and then on the left, here's a human brain. So you can see that this is a large brain. It's very complicated. It has deeper crevices. It has more convolutions. The dolphins evolved their large brains over the course of 35 million years compared to our somewhere between 800,000 and 200,000 years. So it's a brain that's, you know, definitely had a chance to develop into exactly the type of machinery that the dolphins need. Their evolutionary path is pretty fascinating and very different than ours. It started on land about 95 million years ago when, I don't really have a way to picture this for you, but they were small-hooved wolves. They were ungulate wolves, and they were individual predators. Somewhere along the line, at around 55 million years, they decided to go into the water and stay there. And over the course of 20 million years, from 55 million to about 35 million, they went from solitary predators with huge bodies and huge teeth and not particularly large brains to small-bodied animals with smaller teeth who lived more communally and had developed these very large brains. So, and this was a real puzzle to evolutionary scientists, because usually if the body gets a lot smaller, you'd think the brain would follow. The dolphins did something completely different. And this is such a bizarre shape-shifting that the only thing I can imagine would be the equivalent for us would be like we suddenly learn to fly and see through our ears and become giants or something. It's just this wildly colorful evolutionary path. The dolphin brain has arrived at the same destination as the human brain, but in a completely convergent way. It's wired utterly differently than ours. The neocortex, which is very large, is very different than the human. It's missing a layer that in primates is where all the information comes in and is processed. So they're clearly processing information in this very different way than we are. Their limbic system, which is the seat of emotions and, you know, the sort of intuition, the feeling part of the brain, is wildly elaborate and has an extra lobe, a lot of convolutions. And this extra lobe, I spent some time with cetacean neuroscientists who I just fell madly in love with her body of knowledge and everything that she had to say, said this limbic system suggests that they're doing something very sophisticated when they're processing their emotions. And the differences go on and on. And their auditory and their visual areas are right next to each other so that it can allow for very fast processing. The bandwidth that they have in their auditory nerve system is just incredibly wide. And so if you were building a supercomputer, theirs would be the model that you would look at, I think, over ours. But back to Lilly. Here he is in the Virgin Islands. He's got all this funding to study dolphins, and one of the things that he really wants to do is have dolphins speak English to us, because here's these animals that have the ability to communicate, and they obviously have a high level of intelligence, And what he had seen with the dolphins in his lab had really rocked him back on his heels. I mean, they were very aware. He believed they were mimicking his laughter and mimicking his language. And he set up a number of experiments. I have to laugh because every time I saw pictures of Lily in the Virgin Islands, he was always kind of standing around in a white lab coat like Dr. No. And there were all these gorgeous women running around in bikinis. And there were these Mediterranean-style buildings. And part of the experimentation that he did was to flood one building with 24 inches of salt water. And this was intentionally done in an experiment with this woman. Her name was Margaret Howe. You may have heard of her. The experiment's quite notorious. The idea was, what would happen if you took a young female, young male bottlenose, and gave him a sort of a mother figure? Would he, like a human baby, learn to establish language, learn to speak in the way that he was taught? Because we do know that dolphins learn socially. They learn, they have cultures, the information is socially transmitted. They're incredibly social animals. Probably the brain indicates, the way it's constructed, more social than we are even. So what would happen if you attempted to live full-time with a dolphin in a sort of a mother-child relationship? Well, if any of you know what happened in the experiment, you know that the mother-child paradigm was not the one that actually occurred. It was more like some sort of interspecies love affair. And Margaret took many notes. When I was reading her notes, there was this one sentence that says, "He does not go away." It was in italic and underlined. And Peter was, knew what he wanted. He learned to pin her into corners. She had a broom. She tried to ward him off. But after a while, Margaret, nothing if not a trooper, decided that satisfying him would definitely tighten the interspecies bond, and went at it with alacrity. But when word of this got out and word of Lily's other doings, some of it which involved taking LSD and immersing himself in an isolation tank, he invented the isolation tank, as a matter of fact, and trying to understand what it would like to be like to be a mind in the waters and with dolphin sounds piped in, the government funding dried up. But what's really interesting to me about Lily, who I have to say I'm quite fond of, and I've been in his archives, and I mean, he never, never, ever for one second is not interesting or colorful, except possibly at the end of his life when I've heard from various people that he was so ruined by this drug that he liked to take called ketamine that followed LSD that he became largely incoherent. But he had a mind that was fascinating. And if he didn't really dominate the science canon for dolphins, what he did do was he pried open the trap door of our collective imagination about dolphins and whales. And a lot of people believe that it was because of his pronouncements about their intelligence and how different they are that the Marine Mammal Protection Act happened in 1972. My favorite Lily quote is, "There are times that I believe that the dolphins are more mentally healthy than the humans to whom they are exposed." And things, he had a lot of pronouncements like that. And he had a lot of wild conjecture that he put forth that he never was able to prove. And science turned its back on him because of that. But the public wanted to know more. And the public was entranced by dolphins. This is Flipper. Now, Flipper, of course, came right around Lily's era, and all of a sudden this notion that, I could have a pet dolphin, and he's like having a brother, but with fins. I mean, it's like having some sort of member of the family that isn't human, but is equally sentient. And that was a sort of a fantasy, I think, that a lot of us had. I grew up with Flipper. Flipper, the male character, was in fact played by five female dolphins. And around that same time, it was that scuba was brand new. Jacques Cousteau had just come out with The Silent World. There wasn't a sense of what was going on beneath the surface in the ocean. And so there were early marine parks that sound as though they were quite enchanting and very different than what we have now. And this is one of them. It's called Marine Studios. It was originally created as an underwater film set, but on land. So it was a giant tank on the beach in St. Augustine, Florida. It had 200 portholes arrayed around for camera angles, and it was stocked with a whole, you know, theoretical ecosystem of animals, including one bottlenose dolphin who swam around with holding a sign in his mouth that said, "I'm a bottlenose dolphin." And people were, you know, 30,000 people showed up at the opening day in 1938 for this aquarium, and they collected a lot of animals. They were near the Gulf Stream, and the era of having dolphins do tricks began. This is a pilot whale. You don't see a lot of these pelagic dolphins in captivity because, of course, they don't last very long at all. They don't belong in swimming pools. These are animals that roam 70 miles a day in cooperative hunting mode, and their whole life. The most important thing in a dolphin's world are other dolphins. And you take these things away, and you have a creature swimming around there, but it isn't a dolphin. A dolphin is determined by the biology and the, 55 million years of exquisite adaptation into the environment that it lives in. This is a Rizzo's dolphin, another deep water dolphin. But I included these pictures just to give you a sense of how distinct some of the dolphins, differently they look from one another. These are Botos, Amazon River dolphins, and they're unusual because they have, most dolphins have a fused neck and can't really turn their head. They can work their eyes independently, a lot of dolphins, but they can't turn their head, whereas several of the river dolphin species, they have unfused vertebrae, and that makes sense when you think about, like, going under vines and submerged branches and things like that, and they also don't have a dorsal fin as pronounced on the top, and they have extremely fine-tuned sonar and slightly inferior vision compared to other dolphins, which makes sense when you consider how the rivers don't have a lot of visibility. But so the years went on, and we became besotted by dolphins, and their relationship, it was unusual and often, you know, very wrong. And I think the understanding, it was hard forged. I mean, in the beginning, I'll just speak a little bit about orcas because here we are in the home of the most magnificent wild pods. They were considered, probably you all know this, just to be these menacing monsters, and they were used as target practice by almost everybody in the military who came across them, the Air Force, the Navy. They were considered to be just these lethal man-eaters, and the impression that we had of orcas was simply based on watching them hunt and noticing that they're very good at it, but we knew nothing about the animals at all. When Moby Doll, who was the first orca in captivity, was basically captured, they tried to kill her. They wanted to make a plastic dummy of her, but they managed to just wound her, so she came into captivity. And that's when several scientists, some very amazing people who first studied orcas, said, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, whoa! Like, no, these animals should not be in here. This is like, this is something altogether different than anything we've encountered before." But then, of course, came a brutal era of orca captures right in this region. The southern resident pod. Was a third of that pod was taken or killed. They're still struggling to recover, and as well studied as these animals are and as monitored, there is quite a great deal of concern about their viability genetically, and they're living in an area where there's military exercises going on. The sonar, and I'm sure you're all aware that there was a young orca who died several years ago from being struck by a missile. There's a lot of overlap between our interests and theirs right in your backyard here. And the jury's out. But what science knows about orcas is truly astonishing. And they are distinct cultures. The pods have different dialects. They have matriarchal pods and structures within their families, and they're very long-lived animals. I don't even think we know the beginnings of what's going on in the orca world, but they clearly have very distinct cultures. They have rituals. They have ways of living in their niche in the ocean that are brilliant. I mean, there are three different kinds of orcas. There are resident orcas, offshore orcas, and transient orcas, and they all hunt differently. They all use their sonar differently. They've all managed to somehow live together. They don't necessarily get along perfectly well. I mean, transients and residents avoid each other, and every so often scientists will see them scuffle or see tooth raking on the transients. But the residents eat salmon and other fish. The transients will eat marine mammals, and the offshores seem to really like sharks. So if you were a particularly advanced hunter and you were living with other advanced hunters, it makes a lot of sense that you would somehow work it out so that if you you would never really be putting too much emphasis on one prey or another. It would be a more sustainable way to live. I'm going to have to really rush along here. I wanted to look at the phenomena that's growing worldwide of solitary social dolphins, by which I mean dolphins that have chosen to break away from their pods and seek human companionship. And it's a very strange thing when this happens because, as I said maybe 5 minutes ago, the most important thing to dolphins are other dolphins. So scientists don't really understand why this happens, but there are instances of not just bottlenose dolphins, but all kinds of different species breaking away and making a certain area their stomping grounds and having a lot of interaction with the humans who live there. And I had read about this one dolphin in Ireland whose name is Fungi, a bottlenose male dolphin, who is, I mean, Fungi has his own Twitter feed. He has been in this town in Ireland called Dingle for 38 years and counting, supposedly every single day. And he's completely wild. I mean, nobody feeds him. There's no enticement to stay there. There is a huge industry of dolphin watching that has sprung up around this single dolphin. And it seemed so improbable to me that I went there. And I, of course, had all the usual skeptical thoughts like, well, somebody's surely slipping him some food, or maybe this is one or two dolphins. But then Fungi shows up, and he's so distinctive. He's huge, and he has these sort of wrinkles on his neck, and there's just no way that the Dingle Chamber of Commerce could ever swap out another dolphin. I mean, he's as much an individual as the mayor, and I think he's probably more beloved because what I learned was that, the whole Dingle Boatmen's Association does circuits every day of this bay, which is not very big, and it has these extreme tides. So they have maybe 13 boats, and each boat holds about 30 people, and each boat with 30 people on it goes out hour on the hour, 7 days a week, for 15 euros a person, with a money-back guarantee if Fungi doesn't show. And so you can do the math on that. And this town is definitely protecting its dolphin. It's a haven for this. And when I think about all the, the jeopardy that a lot of dolphins go through, the thing that makes scientists worry about sociable, solitary dolphins is the fact that people tend to crowd around them, and their lives are often cut short. They're hit by propellers a lot of the time. Fungi kind of is an exception to that rule, I think, because the town looks after his interests so well. But here's another solitary, sociable dolphin was Luna, the young orca who is in that movie, The Whale, who really wanted to interact with people, and after 5 years was hit by, unfortunately, by a tugboat. And that's more the norm, and more the fate of these intriguing dolphins who really want to make contact with us. And I'm just going to whip through this, but there are towns that, of course, are the opposite of havens for dolphins, and I went to two places where dolphins are hunted, Taiji is, of course, where the cove is. I'm sure you all, if you haven't seen the movie, have heard about it. And I went back to the cove with the protagonist of the movie, Rick O'Berry, and a group of activists who had been inspired to go there after seeing the cove. And as you can see from this picture, the area where it happens is, it's a really spectacular area, and geology has basically, and bathymetry has actually made it possible for them to do this horrible hunt. It's 13 fishing boats that go out, and the season starts September 1st and goes through April. And I would like to report that, you know, that the movie changed something, and it's, the hunt is ebbing, and the captivity trade is no longer happening, but it is not the case. I think the movie has made them angrier and has made them want to hide what they're doing more, but there is a sense, really, when you go there, of heels being dug in. And I think the hope for trying to end the hunt is going to lie within the country itself, because a lot of Japanese people are completely unaware of this, and it's not as if the whole country supports this. It's absolutely barbaric and cruel endeavor. It's not about tradition. The dolphin hunt started in 1969. That there is a whale hunting tradition that goes back further, but not the dolphin hunt is mercenary. And the real impetus behind it is the trade in wild dolphins to marine parks. This is a dolphin being selected out of the pod. In an average, the year that I went there, they had a quota to kill about 2,000 dolphins out of a quota for 23,000 allotted to Japan. And a lot of the other dolphin hunting towns in Japan have actually wiped out the dolphins anywhere near them, which is also, weirdly enough, part of the reason why they are continuing this. They have this bizarre notion that dolphins eat too many fish, and so if they get rid of all the dolphins, there will be more fish. Now, the ocean doesn't work that way. The ocean is productive when there is a fully functioning ecosystem with predators in it. So it's a very bizarre and misguided notion. But it's also worth noting that a young female bottlenose can be sold for up to $200,000. And that's what's happening really at the cove. And the meat is filled with mercury. The movie did a good job of disseminating that information. The Japanese government was feeding this to school children in their lunches, and two Japanese assemblymen spoke out about that, but there is this sort of sense of denial about dolphin and whale meat. It's quite toxic. It doesn't sell for very much money. But when I was there, I saw dolphin and whale restaurants, and they were full of people. But I don't believe that they would go through all this trouble just for $6 a pound to sell the meat. It's, when you are in Taiji, you see these pens like this all over the place where they're being taught some basic tricks. And they're exported to Japan, to China, to Russia, to all over the world, the Caribbean. It's, you know, I wrote in the book, it's a one-stop shopping destination for anybody who would like to buy a dolphin and who is untroubled by the process of plucking that dolphin out of a pool of blood that contains the bodies of its entire family. That's Taiji. The good news is there are amazing scientists and amazing activists doing wonderful work to teach us more about dolphins. I believe we're at a tipping point in our awareness of them and their societies, and that part of our evolution is going to be to understand theirs in a way that we can somehow coexist more harmoniously with the other intelligent life on Earth. This is Lori Marino. She is the cetacean neuroscientist that I told you about, who just, pardon the pun, really blew my mind with the things she told me about the dolphin brain. I had just a blast writing that chapter. And this is Robin Baird and Daniel Webster, amazing scientists from right around here, a group called the Cascadia Research Collective, who have set for themselves a really daunting goal, and that is to further our knowledge of the most elusive deep water dolphin species in the ocean. It's really needle in a haystack work, and very important because there are fewer of these animals, and they're more susceptible to some of the threats out there, like fisheries interactions or Navy sonar reactions, because they live at depth. These are some of the species he studies, and often off the coast of Hawaii, because the shelf drops quickly there. These are melon-headed whales, very gregarious. They hang out in large pods. They love to surf. I compared them to people at an excellent cocktail party. That's what they seemed like to me. This is a rough-toothed dolphin, which is sort of like if a bottlenose dolphin is a BMW. A rough-toothed dolphin is like a Porsche with a front-end spoiler. They jump really high. They have these long, attenuated beaks. They have these sort of calico pink patches on their bodies. But I'm going to end with this video clip. Robin's favorite species, and the one that he has, whenever I would talk to him about this particular these particular dolphins, he would just brighten, and he loved to talk about them. And they're a really little-known species. They're called false killer whales. And they are, again, a matriarchal society with a lot of ritual in their behavior with one another. But what's particularly intriguing is how interested they are in us. He said more than any other animal he has ever encountered. They're quite rare. There are fewer than 200 of them around Hawaii. I'm going to end here. The book, just briefly, the book ends in a sort of a very magical place where it appears that they did have a very different kind of relationship with dolphins. And the oldest artworks that we have that humans made of dolphins date back to approximately 3,000, somewhere between 2,500 and 3,000 BC, and were created by a culture known as, civilization known as the Minoans, who are very interesting and very mysterious, and whom I spent quite a bit of time studying and thinking about and visiting their sites to write this final chapter, in which I hope I can put forth a sort of a more hopeful paradigm for us in terms of our relationship with nature. I mean, these people absolutely loved nature, and their artwork is so whimsical and beautiful, and they were a marine culture, which makes a lot of sense on a planet that is 95% of the living space is saltwater. So I want to wrap up, though, so give enough time in case anybody has a couple questions. Would anybody like to ask anything? Yes. How long do they live? You know, they're pretty long-lived animals. It depends on the health of the animal in the wild, of course. But, you know, an orca is very long-lived. The false killer whales likely have the same, similar lifespans to us. A bottlenose, a healthy bottlenose in the wild, a female could possibly get to into her 60s, and maybe 70s. They've given birth as old as 45, bottlenose females. The males have slightly shorter natural lifespans. But it seems to vary, like us, it seems to vary by the individual as well. Some dolphins are pretty hardy, some aren't. Some dolphins are in difficult situations, like the Gulf oil spill, for instance, was just wreaked havoc on dolphins. And there are other stressors of the immune system that are making it more and more difficult for them to reach their lifespan. Yeah. Yes. The sense of humor. Oh, the question is, do we know anything about dolphin sense of humor? I love that question. It has been observed by many scientists that they are pranksters, that they have a sense of humor. They have been scientifically proven to do something akin to giggling. And a couple examples I can share with you of dolphins showing a sense of humor is there was a... I mean, you could call this a number of different things, but there was a dolphin who had been taught to clean up her tank. So if somebody threw in a piece of something or, you know, something came into her tank, she would, if she took it to the trainer, she could get a fish. They realized after a while that what the dolphin was doing was taking whatever she found and ripping it up into smaller items and hoarding it and storing it so that she could, you know, get a fish whenever she wanted. There's a lot of great stories of dolphins doing things that you wouldn't think the dolphins would be doing. I read about a lot of them in the book, but I think it's very clear that they play seems to be their default state. I mean, they aren't angels. They can be pretty gnarly with one another, but they have this sense of exuberance and play that I think when we see it, we recognize something in it that makes us happy. Thank you for that question. That's a beauty. Thank you. Yeah. Yes. Oh, you know, yes. I heard that so many times, and what I set out to do was take that and prove it. Take it past the point of lore. I didn't want to just repeat the lore, so I looked for stories that I could somehow verify. And my favorite story is this, and it's from a scientist who wrote about it in a book called Beautiful Minds. She was studying a pod of bottlenose dolphins off the coast of Los Angeles in foggy, gloomy conditions, and she was in a research boat with some other scientists, research assistants, and they were following a pod of bottlenose dolphins that was hunting. Typical morning, the dolphins weren't paying a whole lot of attention to the scientists, doing their formation where they're looking for fish, and they found a bunch of fish. And so usually there's nothing that gets a dolphin's attention more than a big batch of fish. These dolphins started to go into their hunting mode where they're herding the fish, and then all of a sudden one dolphin cut away and went out to sea, about 3 miles at top speed. And after a few moments, the other dolphins followed, broke away from feeding and followed. And it was such bizarre behavior that the scientists went as well, followed the dolphins, and they went about 3 miles out to sea. And they were, I guess, 3 miles out to sea in fog, not at any sort of spot that was visible to anybody from where they had been. And the dolphins got there, and they formed a circle. And in the middle of the circle, there was a girl's body floating, a young girl, and she had a plastic bag wrapped around her neck with her ID in it and a suicide note. And she wasn't dead. She was very close to dead, but she was saved by the scientists and the dolphins. So explain that one. I mean, and, you know, there are some verifiable accounts, too. There are a lot of them. It doesn't mean that if you ever are in trouble in the ocean that you should expect a dolphin to zoom in and save you, and sometimes dolphins can get angry and confused and push people out to sea as well, but there's something in their behavior that allows them to understand. Elian Gonzalez, too, the boy who was the sole survivor of the boat from Cuba, you know, the famous case in 1999, he claims that dolphins had continued to push him onto his life raft. And there are a lot of stories like this. Dolphins tend to treat us the way they treat themselves. And if a dolphin is somehow in trouble, incapacitated, can't breathe, unconscious underwater, that dolphin is going to drown if it doesn't get to the surface. So you often see dolphins holding injured dolphins at the surface. If a dolphin's sick or injured, his pod mates will get below him and hold him up. And they seem to see us as something akin to them and do those sorts of things to us. And in some cases, one of my favorite things is in places where dolphins have been fed fish by humans, there's a place in Australia where there's a scientific project. They call it provisioning. They give them, you know, a few fish here and there, not enough to replace their hunting, but the dolphins know to come every so often. They'll get a fish. They will swim up on numerous occasions and try to hand fish back to the humans. And Fungi had done the same thing in the beginning when he showed up in Dingle. He was given handouts of fish, and then he started catching fish and throwing them into boats. It's just, I mean, I could go, there's so many stories. Yes. I certainly hope so. I mean, I think we're as to quote John Lilly, babies in the universe are our species. And I think that if we would like to have any hope of lasting for even a fraction of the 55 million years that dolphins have managed to, that we are going to have to learn to play better with others here on planet Earth and to understand in a really, like, deep way that these creatures are not here for us. They're here with us. And you know, that would be a big step forward. It would be the simple act of respecting these others, these other beings that are here. Yeah. Yes. Orcas will occasionally hunt other dolphin species, and sharks are certainly an issue for a lot of the smaller dolphins, not for orcas don't have any predators. Man is the predator that, the only predator that they, and they seem to know it too, don't they? They have never once hurt us. But other dolphins, a lot of the behavior is intended to ward off sharks. Yeah, and sometimes you see dolphins with big shark bites. One last thing about the when a dolphin is bitten, I just love the science of this. When a dolphin is bitten hit by a propeller, bitten by a shark, big chunk of flesh missing, scientists have really been just absolutely awed by what happens. They heal themselves in a way that is more like regeneration than repair. The wound, you would think it would bleed, you would think it would get infected, because the ocean is like this swirl of viruses and bacteria, and it you'd expect the dolphin to be in intense pain. You'd expect deformity or scar tissue. None of these things happen. I found a paper or a letter in this delightfully named publication called the Journal of Investigative Dermatology that said that they think that dolphins may have a natural morphine in their... They're so perfectly adapted that they are able to regenerate stem cells to build back the tissues that got damaged, that they may be taking antimicrobial and antibiotic compounds from plants in the ocean and storing it in their body and then using it to heal and support the regeneration of these wounds. I mean, these are the things that we will lose if we do not stop this sort of outright war on nature, this exquisite knowledge that we are only just beginning to glimpse. And these are large-brained mammals who've evolved so much longer than we have. We have so much to learn about their adaptations. So I just love sharing that fact because it's like a superpower. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. If you liked what you heard, you might leave a good review. It helps other listeners find us. Susan Casey is the author of Voices in the Ocean, A Journey into the Wild and Haunting World of Dolphins. She spoke at the Seattle Public Library's Central Library on August 17, 2015. Thanks again to Anna Tadashev for this recording. Tune in next week for another great talk. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.